Tony Bang.
On the Empire Podcast this week, we asked George Takei, Star Trek's Mr. Sulu himself, to give as much thrust as a thrust muster can possibly must, while Felicity Jones also pops by to talk about Inferno. All that and more on the movie podcast. It just tidied his desk for the first time all year and is still shuddering from the sight of the Eldritch horrors glimpsed within. Hello Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week I'm joined by three colleagues of such lethal cunning, all of whom are delighted by the news that open auditions are going to be held in London for the London cast of Hamilton. I was excited. I did plan to attend until I found out you just simply can't walk on stage and shout, Bagsy Hamilton! And then that's it. You have the role. Apparently you have to be able to sing and dance and rap and act. And
Yeah. Those are quite important. Yeah.
Well, you know, as Meatloaf once said, none out of four ain't bad. So I think I've got a good chance.
Okay.
I think I can do it.
Best
anyway,
of luck, Chris.
On to those colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up is our geek queen, who'll be reading for the role of Alexandra Winchester, who's a close confidant of Alexander Hamilton's, who is revealed in a shocking third act twist is the great 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 grandmother of Sam and Dean Winchester. Right, and so this actually happens.
Okay.
This actually happens in the US version of Hamilton as well.
Oh, it does.
Then Sam and Dean Winchester come on stage and their shirts just fall off.
Oh my
goodness. Magical, just nips
this,
everywhere.
This musical is gonna run and run.
It's gonna run and run. It's gonna be a 75-year-old Jensen Padalecki's coming on and with his, you know, saggy man boobs at that point. Anyway, it's Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
There we go.
They will never sag.
Next up, we have our genuine theatre guru, a pocket dynamo, who's going to be reading for the role of Tiny Woman number 3.
Peggy.
It is, of course, the intensely focused and concentrated Emma Thrower. How are you?
Hello. Very focused.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. You act, don't you? You actually act.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, like seriously, not like, you know.
Well, you don't mean like acts like a journalist.
Yeah, it's this method. I'm training for a role right now, actually, as we speak.
But you know, that's the career path of Louise Brealey, off of Sherlock. She started out as a film journalist at the
other film magazine. Other film magazines are available.
I don't know what you mean.
You know the one that comes out every month.
No.
That's not us.
No.
Our terrifying foes?
No.
They're totally filmic.
I don't know what you mean.
You don't know them?
No.
Anyway, she started out over there, and now she's like way famous and stuff.
Way famous.
So that could be...
I could be the new Sherlock.
Yeah. You're not going to throw away your... hang on. Shot. And last but not least is a man who is not bothered in the slightest about Hamilton. But you should be, because I'm sure it involves the White House, does it?
Well, funny you should say that.
For West
Wing? Wasn't built yet?
No, it
wasn't.
All right, so he doesn't get it.
Lin-Manuel Miranda is a massive West Wing fan, and there are a number of West Wing references in Hamilton.
That
this is
true.
In fact a fact.
It's James Dyer.
And James does kind of look like a white George Washington.
I've always felt so.
Especially with the headphones on right now.
I look a bit like Lobot.
That's true, he actually does. If you've ever seen the poster for The Lives of Others, that's James.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Bald guy, headphones. Massive headphones. That's pretty much it.
It's a good look. I wear it outside.
It's an interesting look. Lobot had kind of, it wasn't headphones necessarily, was it? It was like,
you know, what do they call the
over the ear,
the Patrick Stewart haircut? You know, the power donut? What is it? Where it's like a cybernetic version of that. That's what Lobot has. He rocks it.
It was like a reverse Geordie the Forge, wasn't it?
Round the back. Yeah.
I sometimes wear my headphones like that, just because
because it's a bit hip hop.
It's a bit looser, you know. It makes me feel a little bit more street.
Mm. People, you are so street.
I am. Yeah, I'm Avenue.
Mm.
That's a street.
Boulevard.
I'm Boulevard. Right. Let's have a question. And this question comes from, and I'm going to mispronounce this because it's a combination of words, letters, and numbers. May not be a real human, but I think it is. It comes from @I0we_A. I think that's
catchy.
Lowie A.
Klingon for Benjamin.
I think it's Lowie A. So she sends in this question, and she asks, in relation to a recent Marvel Netflix show, which we haven't done a spoiler special for because we didn't have access to the showrunners. They didn't come over here, sadly. Luke Cage. Our IMDb, we're not going to go into spoilers for that show, don't worry. But there is a character who shall we say, disappears halfway through the run of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the question is, are IMDb spoiling by including episode appearances for characters and actors on newly released Netflix shows? So if you go to the IMDb and you look up Luke Cage, on the IMDb it'll have an episode number count for each actor. So obviously Mike Coulter is 13 because he's Luke Cage and he's in every single episode.
Spoiler.
And, yeah. Sorry, guys. But it's a certain actor who's a major,
or
major character. I'm using it in the naughty way.
In a naughty way. Oh, you are.
Yeah, naughty's way. There's a certain actor or actress who only has 7 episodes by his or her name.
Correct.
So if you were to look at that, you would go, well, what's going on here?
Well, you know, it's interesting, isn't it? Because they sometimes make assumptions with those. And if you look at those before or just on release, sometimes those are wrong because they've only seen the first 7 episodes that were released to press, for example. Mm. So aside from Luke Cage, who they're pretty confident is in every episode, they sometimes have guessed 7 for people, even though they don't know that for sure. So it isn't always a spoiler. It isn't always accurate because they sometimes haven't seen that much further than you think.
Equally, it doesn't mean 7 concurrent episodes.
Exactly.
Maybe he goes to Maui halfway through and comes back later.
Maybe he's in every other episode, or she.
Forget Maui.
But no, it doesn't necessarily mean that a character dies. It may mean that a character is only called upon to appear every other episode, every few episodes, or has a big arc in the middle of the season but isn't there every single one. I don't think it's a major spoiler, and I think if you're that concerned about spoilers, you should probably
just stay off IMDb.
Yeah, genuinely, you should stay off the IMDb page.
I mean, I have form with this. I'm definitely that person that wants to find out something about someone, say another film they're in, but I will use my right hand to like bar one part and just kind of scroll. People can really see what I'm doing right now, can't they?
No.
And then sort of scroll down and just make sure that I can't see.
Oh, it's bubbly.
I'm a bit.
This is radio, not television.
I know. Sorry. But yeah, so I. Yeah,
that's a quote from Die Hard, by the way.
I've seen it. I just
want to make sure.
Sorry, Citizen Kane. We've totally destroyed what you were saying.
No, it's fine. But yeah, no, I'm a bit like that.
See, you're like the anti-Chris, because people probably know this. Emma doesn't watch trailers. She won't have anything spoiled. And Chris is very, very happy to know what's coming up in
films,
TV shows. You know, you're happy to let spoilers watch over you and have all the knowledge. And I fall somewhere in between. Spoilers. I mean, you know, I won't say that Helen ruined Inferno for me, if indeed
one
can be said to have done that.
I think, in fairness, I ruined Inferno for you. Helen was dancing around spoilers and I just came out and said
that is true. In many ways, Ron Howard ruined Inferno for me.
I think Dan Brown,
he got there first, mate.
But yes.
And also, why would you not want Inferno to be spoiled for you? I mean, we're going to talk about it later on the show. We're not going to spoil it for people.
Because if you haven't seen something, why would you want to know what's going to happen?
I didn't give the key piece of information in that conversation.
You set it up and Chris knocked it out of the park.
Chris spoiled it for you.
I alluded to it in a very clever way.
Which we can't go into here.
It's not up for me to connect the dots, and I'm surprised that James, given his limited mental capacity, managed to do so.
James has already spoiled things for me that are coming up. So
I do my best. Wherever.
I mean,
yes.
Although it is like the final film in the Maze Runner. So actually, I don't know how many people care.
Did I ruin that?
You
I don't
may
remember
have,
that.
Without realising many months ago.
Anyway, so but while we're getting back to this, I think Helen's right. Just avoid IMDb just completely if you haven't seen something. I will never read a review of something I haven't seen, which in many ways defeats the purpose.
But many people use it as a resource. It is.
It's a massive resource.
The internet movie database, and you go on maybe just wanting to find out more about the show, and you see inadvertently that certain actor is only in 7 episodes and you expected them to be in 13, and maybe you go, But, for example, I was looking the other day at, I happened upon this information. I can't even remember what the hell I was doing, but I discovered that there's a US version of Mad Dogs. There's this Sky show called Mad Dogs, which has, the likes of who's in it, John Sim and
Philip Glenister
and people
Max
like
Beasley.
That, Max Beasley. So it's been running 4 series now over here. And so I didn't realize this. I was on Amazon the other day and I just saw that there's a US version of Mad Dogs. And so I wanted to look it up and get more information about it. So the Amazon thing says, starring Michael Imperioli and starring Steve San and Ben Chaplin's in both both versions. Yeah. Starring Billy Zane. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. Our agony uncle Billy Zane is in this show. So I looked it up, and on the IMDb, Billy Zane, brackets, 2 episodes. So you're thinking, okay, so he obviously gets bumped off 2 episodes in. But that's just something I happened upon. But that was, the IMDb just had it, and I didn't expect it to have it. But
it gets worse than that. I remember when I binged the whole of Dawson's Creek, which wasn't actually that long ago. And I think I was preparing for an interview with Michelle Williams. It was something unrelated. And I looked up, and one of the trivia bits on IMDb says, Michelle Williams' character, Jennifer Jen Lindley, dies in the final episode of Dawson's Creek. Yeah. And I was like, well, there's a spoiler motherless.
If you've not seen Dawson's Creek.
Sorry. It really ruined it for me. And I was quite put out by this thing.
It's similar in a way with cameos, because if a film is ranked by a star meter, mm-hmm. then and you don't know someone's in something, that's happened a few times. Or I know people that have found things out, people that you have no idea anything to do with the project, and they'll be right at the top.
Well, famously, of course, Benedict Cumberbatch's character in Star Trek Into Darkness was revealed on IMDb. I think we talked about it even on the show. And I believe Christoph Waltz's character, Inspector, his character's real name was also revealed on the IMDb.
What
because
do you
it's
mean?
Just there. It's just there. It's a bit of blank information. It's just there. It's information.
It's users that do it, though, isn't it? You can do it originally. So the people that put the episodes in, so they're just going, it's this person.
And
but
I think
it can be.
I think in both those cases, it was less a reveal and more of a guess.
Yeah.
I mean, it was there before it was official.
Yeah.
Yeah, quite possibly.
And then I think it was removed and put back, but it was,
You also have this wonderful thing on IMDb of people who are like background extras in huge movies like Avengers and stuff.
Yes, adding themselves.
They add themselves.
Oh, it's really charming. There are some incredible ones. Yeah. Absolutely amazing.
It's fantastic. But I love the IMDb. It's a wonderful resource. And the episode count thing actually works in my favour quite a lot. If I'm watching an old episode, for example, of Law and Order or something like that, and an actor pops up and you just want to check, because they have the episode count on the IMDb, you can actually go to that episode. Yeah. You can go to specific episodes and you can see
what they did in it.
What they did and what the character name, who else is in it, and all this sort of stuff. And it's really, really good. It's a tough one. I would say that the IMDb should keep on keeping on in this case, and just have to tread more carefully, especially with new stuff.
They're the least of the wild worries, though. Surely, I mean, because EW seem to have a personal crusade to ruin the whole of television every Monday morning. So you have to avoid social media for massive chunks of the week if you live in the UK. Thanks, EW.
I've somehow managed to avoid like Bake Off spoilers. That's the weird thing.
This is your bar, isn't it? Yeah. Your bar for spoilers is Bake Off. I mean, you'll read everything that happens in Game of Thrones, but Bake Off, God help us if we spoil it.
Yeah.
Like that gatto failed to rise. Can a gatto rise? I don't know.
Of course it can. It has to rise, or it's not a gatto.
Yeah, otherwise
my
it's just
goodness,
a gat.
James.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I have to watch that on the Wednesday night, no matter what time I get in, because otherwise. Well,
please, no spoilers. I haven't seen this week.
Oh my God, get some perspective.
Really? I tweeted last night. Major spoiler.
This
what?
Is a TV
no, I didn't
show
see that.
About.
Oh, you didn't see that one? Okay, don't.
Cake can be spoiled, James.
Anyone who's eaten one of Helen's cakes would know that. I mean, what? No, I meant Helen made my wedding cake. It's a very, very excellent baker.
I remember that was a good cake. I ate most of it, as I recall.
It was
a
delightful
wedding. I feel like we may have gotten slightly off topic.
Anyway, yes, sorry. Huawei. I hope I pronounced that correctly. And I hope you enjoyed the answer. And you did send in something else as well, another question, and we will hopefully be tackling that in a separate podcast. So, if you want to have your question read out in the Empire Podcast, do send it in to us. We're on Twitter as @EmpireMagazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast. We are on Facebook as Empire Magazine, of course, and you can email us as well. Who emails these days? Honestly. Lots of people do, actually. podcast@empireonline.com. Okay, time now for our first guest. If you've been suffering Felicity Jones withdrawal symptoms recently, then fear not, because she's about to be everywhere. Early next year, she'll be seen in J.A. Bayona's A Monster Calls. Before that, there's a small movie called Rogue One, a Star Wars story, in which she plays the Death Star.
I don't think that's correct.
That would be incredible.
I mean, she'd be great in the role, but I don't think that's her role.
Hang on, just IMDb it. Oh, you're right. Jyn Erso. Yeah. And this week she plays Dr. Sienna Brooks, who helps Tom Hanks as Robert Langdon piece together a mysterious puzzle in Ron Howard's Inferno. We sent our Tom Hanksiest member of the team a thoroughly decent egg called Phil Dissemblian along to talk to her. Do enjoy.
Felicity Jones, welcome back to the Empire Podcast.
Hello.
Very nice of you to take the time to talk to us about playing Dr. Sienna Brooks in Inferno.
It's lovely to be back. Thank you for having me.
Well, that's very nice of you to say. It's a film that sets you up alongside Tom Hanks, a notorious bastard to work with.
Yeah.
Do you have any tips on how to deal with his kind of difficulty?
I mean, it just was insane. It was like throwing chairs, hissy fits, walking off set. I mean, throughout the whole process.
Is he always in his trailer just door shut?
He just does anything just to, you know, make the process as difficult as possible.
You hear that?
So it's really tough.
You hear that about him?
It's really tough for all of us. Not really.
Oh. There's the fake out.
Yeah, exactly. No, he's a very, very genuine, cool person to work with and very professional and focused and hardworking.
He is sort of widely recognised to be the world's nicest man.
Yes.
Does that add enjoyment for you in the movie process?
Of course. If you don't want to work with people that, you know, are mean spirited. On this film, I think we had one of the loveliest casts I've ever had to work with. They really were. Everyone was very good at what they do and incredibly soulful. And there's some lovely moments, I think, in the film from everyone, and real sort of genuine relationship textures in the film.
Tell me the first, just the last Tom Hanks question here. Tell me the first Tom Hanks film you sort of subtly weaved into conversation between takes with him.
So, Tom, I would often ask him about working with Meg Ryan, because I was a huge Meg Ryan fan when I was growing up, and obviously Sleepless in Seattle is such a fine film in its combination of pathos and comedy. And I think that's what Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan both managed to achieve, which is a more difficult thing to achieve than I think people sometimes give them credit for.
Is that your number one then?
That would be my number one. But I do love his work in Toy Story as well. I think it's fantastic. He has such a unique voice. And often with people in films, we underestimate how important it is and how quickly you key into someone because of their voice. And he has that lovely kind of mellifluous tone.
He does. He just kind of.
I just wanted to get that word in as well.
Mellifluous. That's a hell of a word to drop.
I know. Just why not?
I don't know what it means. He's talking about things that are important. Obviously, costume is important to a character, and this is a chase movie. The thing about a chase movie is you don't get to change clothes at any point.
I was so sick of putting on that coat by the end.
Yeah.
Literally, the costume designer and I would say, putting on the same coat again and again and again. Well, it's all, well, that's the joy of it in a way. I mean, despite having to wear the same outfit for 4 months, not literally the same outfit, I have to say. The budget did extend to many versions.
By the end, they bring your clothes out in the bag, like the sort of pathogen.
Yeah, exactly. The team of people fumigated around it. But it's set over pretty much one day.
Yeah.
And so
there's not really excuses for, like, I'm just going to pop into a shop and change.
There's not much time for eating or changing in the film.
No. You said before that you always try on the character's shoes before, I don't know, always, but you have done that before for a week prior to going on set. Did that apply to this one?
Absolutely.
It did.
Absolutely. Because when you first start, you don't want there to be too many things that are completely new to you.
Yeah.
And somehow, if you're suddenly on set and you've never even worn the shoes, they don't have that feel of being part of you, of getting the creases, of feeling comfortable.
Would that apply if you were playing an astronaut? Or
I think anything. It's one of my little idiosyncrasies. It just seems to help.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Did it apply to Star Wars?
And to Star Wars.
Really?
Yes. Yeah.
Because I imagine the shoes in Star Wars would probably stand out in public.
Well, it's interesting. The shoes were adapted, actually, because you can't have laces in the galaxy. There are certain rules. It's fascinating, actually. You can't have zips and you can't have laces in a galaxy far, far away. So you never see, in a Star Wars film, you'll never see any, and I'm sure someone is going to go through and find the moment where one of these things appears. But
yes, they will.
As far as I know, there are no zips or laces, so we had to cover. There were a pair of brown boots, and they're laced up, but we covered them with a Velcro sort of spaceman-like cover.
So it's Velcro in the galaxy far, far away.
You don't see it, but yes.
It's something.
Yes.
Okay.
Maybe they're sort of magically suspended in some way, but basically the Velcro is concealed.
This is terrible radio, but I have to ask you about this. I'm showing you Jyn Erso in Lego form.
Oh.
Have you seen this, and how do you feel about being a Lego person?
I haven't seen it. What is she holding? That's enormous. She has her little mini blaster, and then...
Do you not have that in the movie?
I don't know, but it looks pretty cool. Oh, it looks like a huge baton. I do have a baton, but I don't remember the proportion being quite the same as that. She has a great baton that she has in her... On her gun belt.
It looks like an iPad holder that's strapped to
her side. That she whips
out,
yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so... Oh, goodness. Look at her expression. She looks very determined.
Well, can you just tell me? I mean, I know you can't talk about the details
really
of the film,
cool.
Obviously, but can you tell me what Star Wars sort of means to you and has meant to you growing up? What was your first encounter with the franchise?
Well, early on, my cousins would show my brother and I would go around to their house and we'd go and, you know, have family afternoons together. And quickly after lunch, we'd scurry away from the parents and we'd be watching the latest blockbuster something on VHS. And one of the first films was, do you remember Tremors?
Yes.
That was the first film I ever saw.
Are you serious? That's a great place
to
start.
And it's kind of iconic, isn't it?
Yep. It's a cult classic.
It's a cult classic. And then as part of our training, it was Star Wars was a fundamental...
Yes.
...was a fundamental film in the program. And I do. I clearly remember sitting cross-legged, watching the, you know, when the titles go up at
yes.
the beginning and being completely enthralled.
Do you have a favourite of the... Seven so far. Having said that out loud, that seems like an unfair question because obviously we're now into your own part of
Rogue
the franchise.
One. Forgetting Rogue One is my favorite.
Forgetting Rogue One and forgetting The Force Awakens, do you have a favorite of the previous six?
A New Hope.
Okay. So not an Empire Strikes.
Oh, actually, Empire Strikes Back was a huge influence for us, actually. We'd watch clips of it, Gareth and I. Before we do certain scenes, it's a real real inspiration for Rogue One, particularly that film, and we'd get far too involved in watching it, and then our wonderful first AD Toby would say, "Guys, come on, you got to actually make Star Wars. You can't just watch it."
Oh, you'd watch it when you were on set.
For inspiration.
Right. Okay. A bit like I imagine Tom Hanks on this movie was watching previous Dan Brown movies that he'd done in his caravan just to remind himself how great he was.
Just watching his entire CV.
Yes.
Back. I understand.
It's a good
just
one.
Just helps. It helps you to feel more comfortable on set, realizing how great you are.
We're entering a period of Felicity Jones releases, and we've got a Monster Calls and obviously Rogue One. I think Rogue One first and then the Monster Calls, which when we interviewed you for The Theory of Everything, you mentioned that Juan Antonio Bayona was playing Nicki Minaj before scenes on that film. I've subsequently seen the movie I do not understand. It's an incredible, I really loved it. It's very hard hitting and moving. Nicki Minaj, talk me through that.
Well, that came about. It was for certain scenes between Connor and I, and it was just a kind of if we needed something a little bit more relaxed or a bit of humour in a moment, then he'd splice in a bit of Nicki Minaj in between. In between the beautiful score that he'd already had in his mind for ages, and it was quite unique to have the score playing over certain scenes as you're performing them.
Had you experienced that before?
No. And not since. It's really, really special because then everyone on set, the crew and the cast, everyone kind of comes together and you really understand the tone of the film that you're in, and I found it very, very helpful.
It's sort of music is direction, I suppose, in a way, and just creating the mood.
Exactly, creating the mood.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Nicki Minaj does not make the final soundtrack of this movie.
She doesn't, no. She may be on the extra features.
Did you meet Liam Neeson? Because obviously he voices the monster, the tree. Did you meet him at any point in the process?
We met quite early on and with Sigourney, and Bayona, and we met and had a read through.
Right.
in Soho, actually, and Liam Neeson was there. But that was the only time we met each other, because then he was into motion capture and we don't actually...
No.
My character and his character don't have any scenes together.
Was he doing his full tree monster voice in the read-through, or was that something that developed?
It was that beautiful voice. It's amazing. Isn't it? It's fantastic. It's a bit like when everyone was saying about Scarlett Johansson being nominated for her voice. I feel that yes. Liam Neeson is a strong contender.
Yes.
If there was such a category.
What, mellifluous voice work?
Oh, I like what you did there.
I don't know what it means. I'm just throwing it back.
I like how you... It means honey-like, apparently.
Oh, okay. Honey-like.
It's sort of, yeah.
It's kind of honey-like, but it's also quite deep resonant.
Yes.
And booming.
Lewis. Yeah, it just makes you sound really clever, basically.
It's a great word.
Why not?
I wondered what's next for you after that, because your IMDb page sort of ends with that, and I'm sure you've got other projects.
Yeah, so I'm talking and meeting about various projects, and I'm looking to do something next year, and there's nothing I can talk about yet, but always again finding something. I'd love to do something with a bit of humor and a bit different than I've done before.
Did doing the girls cameo sort of awaken that?
Oh,
urge?
That, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. That show is so well edited. I said to them afterwards, because when you're actually shooting it, you sort of have no idea if anything lands or it's quite a particular tone that you're trying to capture, and then afterwards when I watched it, it all somehow, they obviously know their material so well, and something really special happens in the edit that the timing really comes through.
Yeah. I have to wrap. Thank you so much, Felicity. A real pleasure to chat.
Felicity Jones there, and if you didn't like that Felicity Jones interview, there'll be another one along in about 5 minutes.
Can I just impart a gift,
please,
upon our various listeners?
Oh, and please, that's do.
That, as we were discussing slightly earlier in the office, it's got to the point now where no one can mention the film Inferno without saying it to the tune of Informer by 1993 white reggae artist Snow from his debut album 12 Inches of Snow. See what he did there?
Oh, dear.
And it's at this point, it's driving me mental. Like, I cannot not hear it every time.
I need to hear
and
this
to make
song.
Sure that our readers can't not hear it, here's some of it. Hang on. It should get through a bit.
You might want to hold it closer to the mic.
Yeah.
There we go. These things are directional, you know.
I understand none of these lyrics. Okay, there you go. That is it. Inferno.
Yeah, we haven't made up the rest of it. We need to come up with that, but Inferno. So,
what would the leaky boom boom bit be? I don't know what the hell he's saying, but it sounds like that.
Langdon boom boom?
Apparently, this song came out, I read this on Wikipedia this morning. It came out of, he was accused of 2 counts of murder because someone, I guess, informed upon him. And so he sung an unintelligible reggae song as some kind of street vengeance.
Tom Hanks did this.
It's unlikely, but true.
Wow. Well, he does have a rapper son, Chet Hayes, of course. Did you know that?
I did not.
Do you know that?
I knew that he had this uncle Chet.
Chet Hayes.
I know the one called Colin.
It's not Colin. Right, let's move on to movie news. Let's talk about some movie news.
Yes.
And thankfully, we're recording this on Friday morning because of lots of weird reasons. And I think we're glad we held on because some major news broke yesterday.
Huge news. Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them will be not one film, not two films, not three films, as we had previously been told, but five. This is a 5-act structure on a massive scale.
Not four,
not six.
Not six,
but five. To five shall ye count. with Fantastic Beasts films. And J.K. Rowling made it extremely clear on Twitter last night
yes.
that it was not at least five. It was not around five. It was five. Five is the number.
Such a good tweet.
So, yes. Cinco is the number. Sank is the number. Five. We're counting on five Fantastic Beasts films. I wonder if they'll change the subtitle, if it'll be Fantastic Beasts... and
Harry Potter.
Some people, Fantastic Beasts, on a trip to the seaside. Anyway, that remains to be seen. But I think it's exciting. I'm really excited to see this. It's amazing. We've now seen some of the beasts and they look cool. I want Eddie Redmayne's amazing coat, but I also think that he might be good in the lead role. And I've said all along since this was first announced, I'm really excited on seeing the kind of clash of the Wizarding World kind of aesthetic and this kind of 1920s Art Deco world. I think that's a really intriguing mix and something that we haven't seen a million times before. So yeah, I mean, we obviously have to see number one first and see exactly how excited about this we're going to be. But, you know, on paper, sure.
At least we now know where to find them.
Do we, though?
Well, I don't yet.
I mean, he's just brought them to New York. We don't know where they originally came from.
Well, at least we know where they're going to be in five films. I mean, again, until we've seen the first one, it's really difficult to say. I certainly think more Potter in the world can only be a good thing. There's the part of me that thinks there's an ever so slightly cynical bit of this will make a colossal amount of money for
How
Warner Brothers.
How dare you?
But that doesn't mean they're going to be bad films. In fact, if Potter's anything to go by, they should be very enjoyable. So, you know, yay for good kids films and yay for good family films.
As ever, I am positive. But I love the majority of people in this cast. Ezra Miller, I sort of want to spend my whole life with. So.
Yes, and he's very mysterious. He's been very, very mysterious about this film, and you've kind of got to hope that he's hiding something about the future and it'll be an even bigger role in films to come.
I mean, with that haircut, he's got to be shifty, right?
The haircut is not... I mean, is the last time you saw a good guy with that haircut?
Describe the haircut for people who haven't seen it.
It's a kind of an aggressive bowl cut.
Yeah, it is. Literally.
John, Paul, George, Ringo.
Okay, that was the last time, so it's been 50 years.
The Monkees. The Three Stooges.
Huh. I don't know if they were really goodies. They hit each other a lot.
It's a bit like Smike in some variations of Nicholas Nickleby I've seen.
Peter Beardsley. Sorry, I've just nailed you there.
I don't even know. Who is that? Is that a footballer?
He is a footballer.
Okay. I don't think he has the same cut, though. Honestly, wait till you see it. It's really unpleasant.
It's amazing.
And it is testament to Ezra Miller's natural charisma and charm.
And cheekbones.
Yeah, that he was able to put up with that.
Right. No, I mean, it's like friends.
That was the most wonderful giggle. It was like, you know, his cheekbones.
Sorry.
If we brought him on the podcast, because he's obviously in Justice League, if he's in the podcast, do we need to worry about you?
No,
do
we have the same birthday, so I feel like we're...
Really?
Yeah, I think we're...
Same age?
No. Or he's... No, he's younger than me.
He's younger.
A few years younger.
There's someone also, younger than you. This is astonishing.
Maybe this will give Kelly Reilly a chance to finally be cast opposite Eddie Redmayne, because they are the same person.
Oh, like Judi Dench and Derek Jacobi.
No. Eddie Redmayne is too busy trying to win this season's Great British Bake Off.
That's or is it true. Kelly Reilly?
Or is it Kelly Reilly? Who knows? All will be revealed. Or maybe he's out already. Who knows?
Chris, I'm not no saying spoilers.
No spoilers for me, Helen. I'm just building the mystery.
All right, Sarah McLachlan. Any other news then?
There was a small trailer that broke, we should maybe mention.
Teeny, tiny.
John Wick Chapter 2.
Ah, yes, that's right. Although, to be fair, John Wick Chapter 2 looks brilliant.
I have to confess to doing a fault fast on John Wick.
Yes,
a bit,
naysayer.
Because I didn't much like John Wick first time I watched
it.
I thought that the... Oh, God. This is an embarrassing admission. I thought The Equalizer was a better film. Anyway. But we're wrong. You know, this is the good thing about being human. Humility. And I'm the best at being humble. Is one of our most endearing traits. And I feel that now I showed John Wick to my wife because I saw... Oh, here we go. Drinking game. Yes, he's mentioned his wife. Because I saw the trailer for Chapter 2 and I thought, oh, that's interesting. I might rewatch the first movie. And I watched it the weekend with my wife and it's... Oh, Drinking Game. And it's awesome.
Yes, it is.
And she was just blown away by it. She needed to, you know, to calm down a little bit afterwards because it's ultra, ultra violent and includes a dog being kicked to death, which is just really, really sad, obviously. And some people die as well. But, you know, the dog dies. But it's so good.
It's so good. And the trailer to the second one is very, very exciting. Yeah, that honestly, you know, we live in a very turbulent world right now. There's a lot of depressing and scary stuff out there. And I feel like the John Wick 2 trailer makes it okay again. But speaking of good trailers, that was not the the one we started to talk about, James.
No, although now that's all I can think about.
It's so good, the bit where he's in the this is only the teaser, but it's got Lawrence Fishburne in it, and there's like a Matrix reunion, and you're going, oh wow, God, it's Neo and Morpheus, what's happening? But John Wick's cooler than Neo, what's happening? This is amazing. And then there's that bit where he's in the lobby and he sees his target and everyone sees him and he goes for his gun and everyone just shits their pants because it's John Wick. And he goes, you know, do you want a war or are you going to just give me a gun? And you're like, oh my God, this is the best film of 2017.
And there was a poster came out as well, also from New York Comic Con.
So good.
Very
so
good poster. Good. Yeah. A very good poster. Him so good. Surrounded by guns.
Yes. Which is a play on a Harold Lloyd image from 1918 from a film called Two Gun Gussie, which the image does not appear in the short because I watched it. It's an 8-minute short. It's on YouTube. But that is an image of Harold
it's
Lloyd.
It's also something that a real, I think, Marine drill sergeant did. There's a picture of him with all the guns, basically his entire corps kind of pointing their guns at him up to his neck, and apparently he was able to disarm most of them.
So, well, the amazing thing about that image of John Wick surrounded by all his guns pointed at him point blank is that you feel sorry for those poor bastards pointing the guns at him because he's going to unleash apocalyptic levels of hurt on them. It's really, really great. I'm really looking forward to that. I hope.
Also this week, though, there was a trailer you may have noticed for Rogue One.
Yes.
This is the final trailer, a little bit more kind of substance. We now know that Mads Mikkelsen plays the father to Jyn Erso.
The father of the Death Star. So I wasn't incorrect.
You weren't. You're right.
That's
He's also
true.
A guy who is forcibly conscripted, it seems, by the Empire to do something on a key element of Death Star design. And that seems
he's
to be...
He's a plumber.
It seems from the trailer, it seems that he's separated from Jyn at that point and forced to work on the Death Star. And she's trying to, among other things, get him back. So that's kind of nice. Gives it a little bit of humanity and also gives us a chance to see Mads Mikkelsen, which is never unwelcome. Especially when he's playing at least two scenes opposite Ben Mendelsohn, which I imagine Emma will basically faint in the cinema just watching. So
I can't
that's
talk
really
about
exciting.
Ben Mendelsohn.
It's a very, very good trailer. And of course, I think the standout point of that is it ends with a sweeping shot of Darth Vader coming out of what appears to be the Death Star's bathroom.
Yeah. He's had a really hot shower.
Yeah, and
a lot of
steam everywhere.
I wouldn't go in there for 10 minutes.
It's basically that.
I'd give it a little while if I were you.
He's very... That gave me chills, actually. I rewound that a number of times.
I don't think he's going to be a big part of it.
Neither do I, but it doesn't matter. He's in it, and
that's
it's
true.
Vader.
That shot threw me, I'll be honest with you, because he walks so incredibly quickly in that shot.
And Prowse never did that.
Yeah. So it almost feels like maybe it's a Benny Hill-style chase scene.
Maybe they might have sped it up slightly for the trailer just
they
to...
They might have done.
That's true.
They might have done.
But I really, really properly love that trailer, and I will really, really properly love the film. However,
you've made your mind up already.
However, no. My main concern with that particular trailer is I felt the Williamsectomy upsetting. I found it problematic in that it just was so not Williams. And to me, Williams's unique sound is Star Wars. And I was saying, oh, you know, I love Michael Giacchino. I'm not even sure that's Giacchino's score at this point. Has he even done
it
any other scoring
be.
Yet? It probably isn't his work. It's something else, but it isn't Williams, and it didn't feel like Williams. And I remember when I first saw when Dave Filoni did the Clone Wars film, which, you know, is flawed, but it's fine. The biggest problem I had with that is the lack of Williams meant it just didn't feel like Star Wars. And I'm sure this film will have the fanfare. I'm sure it will have those key things. But if the main score isn't Williams, will that take some of the Star Warsiness away from it? And that's my main concern.
But at some point, Star Wars is going to have to move away from John Williams.
No, I firmly believe he's immortal.
Okay.
Yes.
I like the trailer. I'm hopeful about this movie. Obviously, it's had lots of rumoured trouble behind the scenes, but yeah, fingers crossed. There's that really interesting shot of what appears to be a giant statue of Obi-Wan Kenobi that's toppled over in the desert.
Or yeah, just a Jedi even. And that did seem a little bit odd, because you don't feel like the Jedis would be putting up monumental statues of themselves. But perhaps some local just got really carried away. And then they turned up and had to be all like, oh, that's very nice. I mean, you really didn't have to.
It's been 25 years.
It's exactly like the episode Janestown in Firefly.
It's exactly like Janestown, exactly. Yeah. Yes, with the hats and everything. Amazing.
Yep.
Oh, don't tell us you haven't watched Don't say it.
You porn when news? Firefly came out.
Oh, whoa.
Yes.
What else is happening?
There is other news. Disney are apparently working on a Don Quixote movie, and they have Billy Ray scripting it. Now, this is extremely worrisome for those of us who've been waiting a lifetime for Terry Gilliam's Don Quixote movie, which is due to start shooting this month. People, can you not let him get it in
touch
the can
words.
And let's face it, out and released before you start announcing any competing projects? In fairness, Disney were talking about this back in December 2012. They're now back in active development with The Hunger Games and Captain Phillips, Billy Ray writing the script, and it's meant to be more in the tone of the adventuring tone of the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise, which makes me wonder if any of them have read Cervantes' book. But you know what, I'm just gonna not even get into that, but fine. I just really, really, really want Terry Gilliam's film to come out first and have its fair run at the box office and to have the support behind it. It would be just so good, please.
Poor Terry Gilliam.
Please.
He must be. Poor guy's cursed.
Don't let this make it fall apart.
Finally gets to the point where he's ready to start shooting again, the man who killed Don Quixote. And he goes, well, everything's going well. And it's like, oh, I'll just check what's happening on. Oh, bollocks. Oh, well, I'm sure it'll be fine. A couple of small things I want to talk about as well. One's actually quite a big thing. New York Comic Con happened last week at the weekend, and they had some footage from Iron Fist, like a trailer from Iron Fist. That's definitely a trailer. You can see it online. And it's fair to say I'm not hugely excited about Iron Fist. But the exciting news coming from that was that The Defenders is happening, and Sigourney Weaver is the bad guy.
Yeah. That's super awesome.
So I feel sorry for The Defenders, because Sigourney Weaver may be 67 years old, but she's still able to kick all their asses with just one hand tied behind her back, and she's going to put a hurt on them.
Definitely.
I would say. Well, she'll probably end up being killed at the end of it, but, you know,
what?
I would say if it were actually Sigourney Weaver, playing Sigourney Weaver,
reprising her role from Finding Dory.
Yes, as Sigourney Weaver.
I still would not bet against her. I really wouldn't. She's formidable.
Yeah. That would be a really interesting end of The Defenders. Sigourney Weaver standing over the littered corpses of Daredevil and Luke Cage and Jessica Jones and Iron Fist. And also, it's interesting, no Punisher on that lineup. So they don't seem to have John Bernthal as part of that, which is intriguing. You guys, any thoughts on that?
I'm excited. I'm excited to see it. I'm also slightly reserving judgment on Iron Fist, but, you know, we got to hope for the best, I guess.
We got to hope for the best.
It's the origin of this. Now, as I recall from the comics, he sticks his hand into a mystical brazier. That's brazier, not brazier, which would be a very different type of show.
Yes, and he is not Donald Trump.
And that's how he gets his powers. Isn't it
like a dragon's heart or something that he sticks his hands into, and then they, I think it was originally a dragon's heart.
The thing is, and the problem here is, and I can't say the reasons why, but I didn't like Luke Cage at all. So now I am worried about Iron Fist. Love Daredevil, love Jessica Jones, and I have hit my first Marvel TV road bump, and so I have concerns.
I didn't love the second half of Luke Cage as much as the first, but I still liked him a lot, and I liked some of what they were trying to do a lot.
I liked him. He's brilliant.
Yeah, he's great. But but you know what, reserving judgment, hoping for the best, and yeah, you know, they haven't been massively wrong yet, so.
I have yet to see Luke Cage. It's tricky for me because I haven't had a lot of time, and there's a lot of TV I've got to catch up on, usually of the Bake Off and Menu and Apprentice variety, so they've been fine for my time, but hopefully at some point I will settle down.
Yeah, it's a mere 13 hours of your life
with my wife, who does exist. She's real. And we're going to watch Luke Cage.
It's true, we met her. If she is an actress being paid by Chris to play his wife, like, she's certainly, you know, been available regularly over the years.
Also, in weird title news, there's the news that the Predator, Shane Black's Predator, has been changed to Ollie, potentially.
Got to be a production title, right? It's got to be just a production title, so nobody knows they're making Predator, except now we all know that they're making Predator.
I love the idea of this beast prancing around the jungle called Ollie.
Yeah, we now know the Predator's name, and frankly, just kill me.
Well, Oliver.
I genuinely, that would, I mean, I don't think they're going to call it Ollie. No, I think that's just the production title. But the news, of course, yes, is
that Benicio del Toro is out.
Right.
Because apparently he's busy and got other stuff to do.
What?
And Boyd Holbrook, who I love, is in.
Interesting.
Very different. Very, very different actors.
Very different. So Boyd is in Narcos.
Yeah.
And he's about to be in Logan, the yep, new Wolverine movie.
Yeah, he's in Gone Girl. Please watch The Skeleton Twins. He's in that. Yeah, he's I think, a really interesting up and comer. He's having a great time right now, but yes, yeah, so different to Benicio, but that's interesting. I'm obviously, being someone who didn't grow up in the 80s, I came to Predator late, blah blah blah, but I do love it and I'm super intrigued to see what they do with this. Shane Black's obviously an absolute hero, and so hopefully that's going to be pretty fun, which
yeah,
will be a nice twist. But I don't know, I just find the idea of this beast being called Oliver absolutely hilarious, and I
hope maybe he just skateboards,
maybe he just ollies, yeah, who knows.
This could be very exciting to see what happens with Ollie coming 2018. I know a lot of Ollies, and none of them are invisible killing machines.
Or are they?
Or are they? Wait a minute, here he is! Oh, God! Okay, that's it for the movie news. Time now for our second guest. He's one of the founding members of the Starship Enterprise, a valued crew member throughout the original series, the animated series, and the first six Star Trek movies. And as I discovered when I spoke to him recently when he came into London, he's a brilliant raconteur, a lover of the stage, and much, much more besides. He is, of course, the legendary George Takei, who came to the UK recently to attend Destination Star Trek up in Birmingham and plugged the hell out of the new Star Trek box set like no man has ever plug the hell out of something before. Have great fun with this interview. I certainly did. Hope you enjoy it. We're delighted to be joined on the Emperor podcast by the great George Takei. Hello, sir. How are you?
Just great. We're in London and we brought our California sunshine with us. So we have the best of all possible worlds.
Is that what it is outside? Because
that's what we brought with me.
It's October.
We opened our luggage and we went like this. But we went like this in London and we have all the delights and wonderful theater of London.
Oh, fantastic. So have you been checking out some shows?
I have. We arrived Friday night, and I saw the best, the first thing this trip. Uh-huh. I saw a matinee of The Entertainer with Kenneth Branagh.
Yes.
Written by John Osborne. Mm-hmm. It was absolutely brilliant. In fact, he moved me to tears.
Oh, wow.
He is an amazing actor, Kenneth Branagh. And then that evening I saw The Go-Between with Michael Crawford, and that was all right.
Yes.
And then yesterday we saw a revival of a 1968 play that I saw in New York called The Boys in the Band.
Oh, yes, yes.
And it is still powerful and relevant, wonderfully acted by an excellent cast, and good-looking cast, which is important in The Boys in the Band.
Absolutely, absolutely. If you're still in London, I'm going to recommend the play That Goes Wrong. It's fantastic.
Where is it playing?
It's at, I think, the Duchess Theatre. It's a fantastic, wonderful...
Is it an original?
It's an original comedy. Very, very funny. The Play That Goes Wrong.
The Play That Goes Wrong.
That's my recommendation to you.
On Broadway, we have a play, and it's hilarious. Mm-hmm. Something Rotten.
Okay, okay.
You know where that's from?
Yeah, where's that from?
Shakespeare.
Shakespeare, of course.
Something's rotten in the state of Denmark, and this play is rottenly hilarious. It's about Shakespeare, actually.
Oh, really?
Or two brothers who are aspiring playwrights, and they see Bill Shakespeare as their big competition. Something was rotten there.
He'll never amount to anything like Shakespeare, mark my words. But obviously you started off, we were doing a sound check and you were quoting Shakespeare. So is the Bard important figure for you? Is that someone?
Yes, yes. Most actors, you know.
Yeah.
And my graduation present from the theater at UCLA, University of California at Los Angeles, was a present from my parents, a summer session at the Shakespeare Institute at Stratford-upon-Avon in Warwickshire.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It was the most glorious summer that I ever had.
What did you do there?
Well, I sat in the cemetery of Trinity Church, watched the swans glide by, as I read Macbeth and Twelfth Night and A Midsummer Night's Dream in a cemetery.
What a lovely setting.
What
a glorious setting.
It was, yeah. With all that history. And to know that Bill Shakespeare's bones are a moldering just a few feet away from me at Trinity Church.
Amazing, amazing.
And there were graves are moldering right around me, all around me.
Yes, absolutely. Well, yes, indeed. But, you know, one of particular note.
Most certainly.
Indeed. So I guess then, were your experiences with Nicholas Meyer on Star Trek II and Star Trek VI, because he worked in a lot of Shakespearean references. And
yes, he did. The very title,
yeah,
The absolutely. Undiscovered Country, indeed. Which I think is mistitled.
Okay.
Star Trek VI... true subtitles should be Captain Sulu to the Rescue. That's what it's
That's
about.
That's right.
Who does it begin with? It begins on the Excelsior, yes, with Captain Sulu, yes, a brand new captain in, yes, this brand new ship, much bigger than the Enterprise. And we go off and running when Praxis explodes,
yes,
and makes that great ship tremble.
Yes.
Just about in the middle, when Captain Kirk is about to be blown away to smithereens by the Klingon captain played by
Christopher
yeah. Plummer. Who should come to the rescue? He's about to blow Kirk to kingdom come, but yes. Captain Sulu, out of the darkened galaxy sky,
yes,
and blows the Klingon captain and indeed ship away,
indeed,
thus saving Captain Kirk.
Absolutely.
And the traditional classic ending of all Star Trek television episodes as well as the movies, on the bridge of the Enterprise, with the captain in the center seat.
Yes.
And he looks up at the view screen at the giant image of Captain Sulu.
Yes.
And in essence, he says, "Thank you for saving my ass." And Captain Sulu says, "Good to see you in action one more time, Captain." And he roars off. And there's an absolutely awestruck McCoy looking at that giant ship go off. And he says, "By God, that's a big ship." And Scotty chimes in, "Hey, but not so big as that a captain, I think." That's a Captain Sulu movie.
It certainly is.
Captain Sulu to the Rescue. That should be the true title of number 6.
Not quite a Shakespearean, but I like it. I like where you're coming from.
But yeah, then Shakespeare made a mistake. He should have said something about Captain Sulu in one of his masterpieces.
Absolutely. You need to get a time machine, go back 400 years, and go, "Bill, I have some notes."
Yes.
A little suggestion. Instead of maybe Hamlet, could you call him Sulu? And we'll take it from there. It'll all be fine.
Oh, wouldn't that be delicious?
It would be amazing. So in the early days of Star Trek in particular, when you guys were, when the show was on TV and you guys were working together, did you do plays during the off season or when you were on hiatus? Did you support each other? Did you go to see each other in plays?
Actually, I saw Leonard in a play before I did Star Trek. I saw him in a small theater, mm-hmm, on right off of Santa Monica Boulevard, mm-hmm, doing Jean Genet's Death Watch.
Okay, yes.
And I was doing a civil rights musical titled Fly Blackbird, uh-huh, when Nichelle Nichols, who knew one of the cast members, came to see it. And I met Nichelle for the first time, also before Star Trek. So I had connections with two of the Star Trek actors even before Star Trek.
Amazing, amazing. And now you're in the UK. You're going to Birmingham later this week for,
yes,
Destination Star Trek.
For a great big, yeah, 50th anniversary whoop-de-doo. Star Trek whoop-de-doo.
Is that a Shakespearean term? I don't think it is.
Shakespeare could have been a bit more worldly.
As you said, he's not going to amount to anything 400
Midsummer
years later.
Midsummer Night's whoop-de-doo. How's that for a title?
That's a much better title.
It's a box office smash. Yeah. Well, just that title alone, don't you think?
I like it a lot. It's amazing. What is the convention circuit a big thing for you?
these days?
Well, particularly this year,
yeah,
because of the 50th anniversary. A few months ago, we did one in Bonn, mm-hmm. and there was a great big one in Las Vegas, which was another planet altogether. and there have been many other conventions, but those three, Bonn and Birmingham and Las Vegas, I think are going to be three of the biggest.
Oh, wow. Okay. So has this year in particular been a special one for you in terms of, you know, Star Trek's in everyone's mind, the anniversary is there, we've had a new movie. Is it something that's really driven at home? I mean, imagine that it's a huge part of your life
it
at
is.
The best of times. But
Star Trek has really defined my professional career. Mm-hmm. Until then, I was doing guest shots on television, a couple of feature films with legendary actors. Yes. With Richard Burton, I did Ice Palace, 2 weeks on location with him in Alaska and 2 months back at the studio. Mm-hmm. And I did a film with Cary Grant, yeah. titled Walk, Don't Run. Uh-huh. And also I did a film with John Wayne,
yes.
Between the first season and second season, mm-hmm. during the hiatus of Star Trek, called The Green Berets, mm-hmm. About the Vietnam War. Thank God we didn't go on location to Vietnam. We went on location to Fort Benning in Columbus, Georgia.
Okay.
So yes, much safer there.
Just down the road, essentially.
Yes.
Okay.
And this year we're also celebrating the 50th anniversary with this extraordinary, once-in-a-lifetime mm-hmm. collection of all of the original cast's TV episodes mm-hmm. and all of the original cast's feature films.
Yes.
And we also became an animated series.
Yes. Yes.
And all of those episodes, all done on Blu-ray, DVD. Mm-hmm. And that also comes with six original mini posters for the six films that we did. And to boot,
yes.
there is a documentary
uh-huh.
about the making of Star Trek.
Yes.
But wait.
Okay.
There's more.
Okay. I'm excited. This is good.
20 hours uh-huh. of various special Star Trek treats.
Wow. Okay.
That's intriguing. It.
I'm intrigued, George. Do you take cash or credit?
Because we'll do both. We'll take whatever you have.
I'll take two. One for me and one for my wife. It's going to be great. A lovely Christmas gift.
It
sounds great.
One for you and one for her.
Absolutely.
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 This is what it looks like.
Yes.
Alas, we're not on camera, so they can't see it. But it's a handsome package.
It's a very handsome package.
Done in gold,
yes.
because it's the golden anniversary, 50th. Mm-hmm. And there are silhouettes of all seven of us.
Yes.
But they're only silhouettes, because if our faces are recognizable,
uh-huh.
Paramount would have to pay more.
Kerching, do you take cash or credit? Once again, we go back to that. It's amazing. So it is a golden anniversary. Have you been exchanging gifts with your castmates?
You know, it happened on the 8th of September. That's okay. The birthday, 50th yes. birthday of Star Trek. Maybe I should get some gifts a little bit late, because, you know, we usually get gifts for our friends after their birthday.
Yeah, of course.
So
of course.
This weekend I'll be seeing Walter,
uh-huh.
and I don't think Nichelle's going to be there.
Okay.
And
okay.
the only other living one
yes.
is Bill.
Yes.
Bill, I think, deserves my presence.
I think it's fair to say that your relationship with Bill has been strained over the years.
Not really. I mean, I
okay.
see him at these yeah. conventions,
okay.
and I talk to him.
That's good.
But yes, we do have a history.
Yes.
We all have a history with Bill.
Yes.
Every single member of the cast.
Well, can I suggest a good present for Bill?
A present.
A present. The Star Trek
Why
box
should,
set.
I thought I was being very generous with the gift I was planning to give him.
Just your presence.
I told you my presence is his gift.
Just a warm handshake. That's gift
it
enough.
It could be a little on the sweaty side. and I'll wash it right off.
So not strained at all. It's all good. It's all good. I wanted to ask about the animated series, George, because it's a strange footnote in Star Trek history, and I don't think a lot of people even really knew it existed. It only ran for 2 seasons. But it was that lovely story that initially Bill and Leonard and DeForest were brought on as voices, and they said, we
and
do
Major.
This. Yes, and Major, yes, of course.
And Jimmy.
Yes.
They were to do their own voices, but Jimmy was to do all of the other male voices as well. Yes. And Majel was to do not only her character, yes, Nurse Chapel's voice, but all of the female voices. And when Leonard found out about that, he said, well, where Nichelle and George? Yeah. And they said, well, we don't have the budget for them to do their voices. But Jimmy Doohan will do a very good Sulu, and Major will do a very good Uhura. But Leonard said, what Star Trek is about,
yes,
is finding strength in our diversity. The Enterprise was supposed to be a metaphor for Starship Earth, yes, and it was the diversity of this starship. People of many different races, many different faiths, yeah, many different cultures, all coming together, working in concert, confident of our problem-solving capabilities, of our innovative and inventive genius, and our entrepreneurial spirit. That's, yeah, why the ship is named the Enterprise. Mm-hmm. And the two people that personify our diversity are Nichelle and George.
Yeah.
And if they are not going to be a part of this series won't reflect what Star Trek is really about. And I'm not interested in it. It was an extraordinary statement on his part for an actor to say, I'm not interested. I'm going to walk if Nichelle and George are included, to sacrifice his own job for two other actors. But he did. Mm. And Leonard is absolutely essential for Star Trek. Spock is the pillar, centerpole character. And so they somehow found the money to cast us. So, yes, I do owe the animated me, yes, to Leonard Nimoy's principled stand.
Amazing. Well done.
He truly personifies the spirit of Star Trek.
Indeed.
And the conscience of Star Trek.
Indeed. The animated series, just one last question about that. I spoke to Dorothy Fontana recently. We ran a piece on it in the magazine about how everyone was in different places when the show was being recorded. So sometimes Leonard would be doing a play, he had to record it somehow in a different city. What was your experience of recording your lines? Did you have to, was it a scramble to record your lines? Were you on location somewhere else?
It was like that for all of us. Yeah. But it was not the most satisfying way to work for an actor. You know, because when we do the film versions, we're playing with each other. Each other's voices, rhythms, and actions. And too frequently, you know, I'd be reporting to my scheduled appointment, and Jimmy would be leaving. So I would be in that booth all by myself, and we would record our lines separately, individually, and disjointedly. And so it was not a very satisfying way to work at all. But unfortunately, that's the modus operandi, yes, for doing voiceovers.
Were you in full costume? I need to know.
I could lie and say, yes, we were. And I got into makeup as well. All set to be completely. Every, yes, inch of my body, yes, would be Sulu.
Absolutely. It's the only way to be. You got to go method, George.
We
have to go method.
Are artists of integrity. I mean, do you think we would shirk part of what we...
No, of course not.
We become the character.
Of course not. Absolutely. Absolutely.
To do voiceovers, you have to have everything, yeah, helping you out.
Yeah, of course.
To find the tempo, the tenor, the timber, the whole thing.
And we have to wrap up.
Oh, the things you can get away off a podcast.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm absolutely... I've got nothing on underneath my... I just, you know, the listeners have no idea.
You're welcome.
They have no idea.
Please do. Be comfortable.
George, it has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Can I put my clothes back on
now? Put your clothes back on and put me down for 5 for Lewis box sets.
Oh, very good.
As long as you take a check. Do you take a check?
Oh, I'm sure we will.
All right, excellent. All right, brilliant. George Takei, thank you so much indeed.
Live long and prosper.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Awesome.
Yep. Good old George Takei. What a, yeah, very, very interesting guy. Let's talk about movie reviews. Let's talk about the reviews. And there's only one film, really, to get our teeth into this week. It's Storks. No, wait, no, it's not. It's Inferno.
Yeah, we got nothing.
No. We'll come up with something.
I wrote the review for this, so let me go first. It's another Dan Brown adaptation about Professor Robert Langdon, who's still teaching symbology, whatever that is, at Harvard.
It's anology.
It's anology. It is anology. You always need anology. But in this film, he wakes up in a hospital bed in Florence with no memory of the last few days or how he got there.
Oh, I wish I had no memory of the Da Vinci Code and Angels and Demons. What a blessing.
He's only lost a few days.
Oh, so he knows who he is.
He knows who he is.
I'm Professor Robert Langdon.
It takes him a little minute or two to kind of get up and moving, which is a problem because someone is trying to kill him. So his doctor, Dr. Sienna Brooks, played by Felicity Jones, as we've discussed, has to get him to safety and then help him figure out what the hay is going on.
What is the hay going on?
Well, I'm so glad you asked. It turns out that Ben Foster, who's so known for playing cuddly, friendly guys usually, is actually, in this case, a tech billionaire who's obsessed with overpopulation. We see a sort of TED talk that he gives at the beginning. And he has devised a thing that will solve overpopulation by killing half the population of the globe. Unfortunately, when he was being chased by Omar Sy, who's a SWAT team member working for the United Nations Health Organization, I'm sorry, he throws himself off a building and dies. So the race is on, basically, to discover his bioweapon and make the world safe for half of its population.
Cheery.
It's and of the course, end.
Yes.
Yes.
The end. And if you want to see a film about population control via a manufactured virus, watch Dennis Kelly's Utopia, available on DVD.
Yeah, I mean, there are... It's a very old problem that's been discussed a lot in science fiction. Sherry Tepper has done several great books on it. All of them better than this, I think it's fair to say. I gave credit in the review for two things. I think it's interesting to kill off your villain at the beginning, so everyone's chasing him down, but he's not there pulling strings in the background.
Do they know he's dead?
Yes.
Robert Langdon
knows he's
dead.
Everybody knows he's dead.
So he doesn't just keep forgetting, does he?
No.
He doesn't go, oh...
He keeps having nightmarish visions, though. So apparently they're actually based on Botticelli visions of hell, but I thought they looked rather Hieronymus Boschian, but, you know, there you go. He's dead. Everybody knows he's dead. So it's basically various factions sort of doing stuff. But there are assassins.
This sounds
around.
Amazing.
Well,
this
I sounds mean,
could
it
be even better than the Da Vinci Code and the Ancients and Demons. I know that's difficult.
That's a bar, isn't it? I think it's clever to kill him off at the beginning. It's clever to disorient Langdon because he can be so freaking obnoxious when he's explaining everything to everyone around him that it's quite good to have somebody else have to explain things to him occasionally, which is quite nice. The problem is the film is just really boring and they're running around all the obvious places in Florence and other cities that come into it. And you're just like, well, I've seen this on the postcard. Like every postcard has exactly this in it. So what are you doing? And there's more vandalism of priceless work of art, which always slightly upsets me. Yeah. I still haven't forgiven him for the bit in Angels and Demons where they just ripped that Galileo manuscript in the Vatican. Literally the entire cinema I was in went... So
yeah, it's just nonsense, isn't it?
Yeah.
The whole film feels like it's sponsored by Thomas Cook. I mean, the whole it's just how you go here on holiday. Also, and maybe that I'm just quite still on the uptake, but I understood none of it. Like, absolutely none of it. Like, every time he would look at some piece of art and he'd go, oh, well, this clearly indicates that this and this, and he changed this to this, and therefore we have to go here. And I'm like, what on earth are you talking about?
But you did theology. You know that he'd rearranged the circles of hell in that painting.
Do you know
right?
what I mean? And I was just like, this is just madness, because even though he explains it, you still can't follow his logic in what leads to what. And, you know, I mean, Da Vinci Code is flawed. Angels and Demons is flawed, but at least you kind of know what's going on, and there's an element of trashy airport page turner to them. They're not unwatchable. This, I think, is a bit of a low point. What happened to The Lost Symbol? I've no idea, because this is actually the fourth Langdon story, isn't it? And the third one seems to be
Don't
lost.
Discourage them from skipping some, James.
Well,
come
don't,
on.
Don't think for a second they won't go back and make it.
The thing is, I'd still happily watch another one. I found this quite difficult, but I really like The Da Vinci Code, which I'm sure shocked you, James. I really like it, but I just felt like everyone was struggling with their lines. So I could see Felicity Jones almost sort of being like, I'm telling the audience something that I know they know because they can see me doing it. It's very exposition heavy.
It's so exposition heavy.
Which, you know, I know that there's a lot to explain, and that's great because I'm a clever person, but I'm stupid at figuring things out in films. And I found that very helpful.
See, my problem was I guessed a thing really early, and I never guess anything.
So did I.
Really early. Yeah, you guessed it without even
seeing
the film.
Time I read the Wikipedia entry.
Right. Oh, Chris.
That's when I guessed it.
So I hadn't done that. I'd just like, for the record, to say that.
It's but easier to read a Wikipedia entry of a Dan Brown novel than it is to read the Dan Brown novel.
That is true. That is true. Although it takes about the same amount of time.
Yes, it's not the same experience.
But what the explanations thing was amazing, because not only did they explain it, they would then explain it in simpler language. So there's one point where one character says to Langdon, it's a bioaerosol. And Langdon goes, so it will spread through the air.
Yeah. Like, I don't know,
that bit I understood.
Really? I'd happily be a little bit out of it, you know, and try and get my brain to work a bit harder. I know that if I'm being sort of pandered to slightly, that then that is a problem for everybody else. But I would watch Ben Foster, I've said on Twitter, I'd watch Ben Foster watching someone watching paint dry. I think he's astonishing.
That would be exceptionally dull.
No, it's Ben Foster. No, I think he's incredibly talented.
I'm going to make a list of all the people you've been really weird about in this podcast. Ben Foster.
That's not weird. That's me.
It's very weird.
Him for his acting
you would
talent.
Watch him watching paint dry.
No, watching someone else watching paint
dry. Who's the someone else? Boyd Holbrook.
That would work. It doesn't matter who.
It doesn't matter. It's just go with the concept, Chris. It's not a weird concept.
No, I think Ben Foster's great, and I want to see more of him.
He's
on
very good.
Well, I'm sorry, but his character's dead, so you're not going to get it.
Oh, what?
And we can't go into details about the end of the film for obvious reasons. But
it sounds like we could do a really interesting spoiler special about this film.
We should record that.
And it makes never let anyone
no
see
coherent
it.
Sense the
no
ending
sense.
As well. I mean, it's just ludicrous.
But I did enjoy Irfan Khan's character, who is actually having fun, unlike anyone else.
Absolutely.
And also, Tom Hanks is beginning to let some of his natural charm shine through Langdon's boringness. So, you know, full marks for that. So I gave it 2, not 1, basically, is what I'm saying.
So T. Hanks for the memories. Makes no sense, but anyway, just like the film, I guess. So Inferno gets 2 stars, which is not a recommendation on this podcast. Or in life, I guess, really. Unless, of course, you're a general in the army.
Okay.
Profound. So last week on the show, we had Andrea Arnold, a brilliant British director. Her new movie is American Honey, which stars Sacha Lane and Riley Keogh and Shia LaBeouf. And Emma Thrower is going to tell us more about it now.
So American Honey is Andrea Arnold's first American film after doing Red Road and Fish Tank and Wuthering Heights, which we're all pretty much in love with, I think, a lot of us at this table.
Apart from Wuthering Heights, totally with you.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And it follows Star, who's played by Sacha Lane, who's a young woman that Andrea Arnold found on a beach in Panama City during spring break, which is ridiculous. And she's in this sort of abusive home setting where she is picking up frozen chickens from dumpsters, and she has these 2 little children with her, and we don't quite know why. And she's desperate to get away from the place that she's in. And luckily for her, it just so happens that she comes across this guy, Shia LaBeouf, in a sort of Kmart. And he's dancing around with his friends, and she's sort of intrigued. These people, you know, these strangers, what are they doing? Dancing to Rihanna. And then he propositions her in a car park and sort of says, you know, what are you doing with your life? Do you want to come with me? We're going to go across America. We sell magazines. And yeah, she basically goes, okay, I'm going to leave these 2 kids with their mother, and off she goes on this crazy little adventure. And that's basically the premise. It is this sort of long, meandering, drawn-out journey with a lot of non-actors, apart from Shia and Riley Keough, who plays his sort of on-off, we're not too sure what their relationship is, partner. They're going from door to door in Kansas City.
Among others, yeah.
Yeah, trying to sell these magazines, telling these stories, sort of sob stories, and she keeps getting paired up with Shia and trying to learn from him how to make money. Every night they go back to these motels, they're drinking, they're partying, basically having a really good time. But it's very clear that Star is completely lost, isn't it?
Yeah. I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because they're living this quite hedonistic lifestyle on the surface, but there is this kind of threat of poverty underneath. Like, it's made very, very clear, if you don't make your targets, if you don't sell magazines, we will just leave you behind
on
wherever we
road.
Happen to be. Yeah. And so it's kind of an interesting, I think it's probably like quite a good metaphor for just millennial life, isn't it? Because, sure. You know, it looks great from the outside, but there is no economic security. There is no kind of place of safety. And she's kind of just trying to find her way. And I think it's interesting that, you know, a lot of films, I think, would see her escape from her sort of home life we find her in the beginning, which is clearly abusive, clearly incredibly deprived. They would see that as a victory in itself. They would see that as a sort of an end to the story rather than a beginning. In some ways, it's the end of Red Road is the kind of the beginning of this film. But it really isn't. It's just another stage here. And I think she's still lost. She's still trying to find her way. She's still trying to figure out what she needs to do. She does some incredibly reckless things.
Oh, yes.
She does some incredibly self-destructive things. Every time Shia starts a sort of story and seems to be getting on a roll and seems to be convincing people to buy from them, she kind of sabotages it because she just isn't willing to pander to these people. She isn't willing to be dishonest. She's like, well, why would I do that? You're no better than me. Why, you know? And there is that kind of toughness and that kind of tough facade, I guess, over something that's really just really vulnerable. And I think that's Andrea Arnold's great gift, is she presents her as a fully rounded character. There is no way that even the most conservative critic, I honestly believe, could go into this film and sort of come out kind of disapproving of this young woman and her life and her life choices, because she's such an empathetic filmmaker that she just puts you right in her shoes.
Absolutely. And it's such like an honest performance, isn't it? It's just
amazing.
I can't imagine, you know, any actual actor sort of filling that role. She did say on the podcast last week that she had someone right up until the 11th hour, but then that didn't work out. So, you know, they found Sasha and it's just worked out.
She's astonishing. She's astonishing in this film. And I think she's, you know, Arnold has a real eye for talent. I think, you know, Kyla Scodelario and Wuthering Heights, Michael Fassbender, really before he broke through, Kate Dickey as well. Like she can see people before I think they kind of break through. And I think this might be one of those times. This could be really, really be the start of something. It's also like a huge, not, I don't even know if it's a return to form for Shia LaBeouf. It's the best he's ever been, I think.
He's one of those actors that has the ability to just kind of get me right in the gut, and I don't quite know why. In that, he just really, you know, when you just get, you kind of feel almost aggressive towards the screen, you kind of feel yourself. That performance is so visceral. I felt very much like I was sort of having a battle with him, which I thought was a really interesting, you know, watching experience. They have a lot of intimate scenes, him and Sasha, and I think, you know, I kept forgetting that I was watching a film. I was just kind of watching these two people. Yeah. And it's hard to forget Shia as Shia. And that's always going to be tough, but that is...
But you do, I think. I really think you do. I mean, the bum bag and the rat tail help. God help him.
But yeah, I think a lot of people will find it a bit too long or aimless, unfortunately.
It is unquestionably both. I think it is too long. It is almost completely plot-free. But I think as a character piece and as a filmmaking piece, like, it's beautifully shot as well. I think it's
Robbie Ryan.
What a guy.
The old Academy ratio. I think that the meandering kind of style works for it, though.
Yeah,
I really, really like it. I felt like I'd lost a friend at the end of it with little Sasha, and yeah, I think going back to it, it'll probably work its way up my films of the year quite easily. I think Return Watches will do it a lot of favours, actually.
Yeah,
really, really liked it.
Yeah, me too. So we gave that 4 stars, which is very much a recommendation. And I'll be honest, I wrote the review and it was a high 4. I did flirt with 5, but it was just the length, really. So yeah.
4 stars in for American Honey. Probably the film of the week.
Yeah,
absolutely, unequivocally, definitely. The film of the week. Also out this week is an animated movie called Storks. Kelsey Grammer was on a few months ago and he revealed the end of Storks to us on the podcast. We cut it out, but
yes, I did.
So there you go. But he's in it and it's an animated movie about storks and we gave it 2 stars, and I kind of wish we'd left the end in now, to be honest, but there you go. And also out this week is Kate Plays Christine, which is the first of 2 movies about the tragic US news anchor Christine Jubbock, who committed suicide on air in 1974. The next movie, which is simply entitled Christine, stars Rebecca Hall. That's going to be out in this country next year, we think. It doesn't have a release date at this point, but this one is intriguing and engrossing, but not entirely satisfying. 3 stars for Kate Plays Christine. And that's it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, where we'll be joined, all being well, by Cobie Smulders, star of Jack Reacher,
yes.
Never Go Back. All very, very exciting. And if we're not joined by Cobie Smulders...
Ben Foster!
Watching Boyd Holbrook, watching paint dry. Until then, it is goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from Emma.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Jimbo.
Bye-bye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to go down the market and get some box sets off George Takei. Very interesting indeed, Governor. See you next week. Bye.